Welcome to the Biomedical Frontiers podcast, where we explore pivotal research projects and disruptive innovations aimed at translating scientific advancements into tangible healthcare solutions. I'm your host, Dasha Tischler.
Cardiovascular conditions, just writ large, affect nearly 48% of Americans. So literally, if you're, you know, in a large room, almost every other person.
What specifically are you working to impact with Heartbeat Health?
There's an actual ROI on really investing in this type of preventative or proactive care. And we found that, you know, it can be 3x in some cases and as high as 9x. While you do have to put a little bit more effort and human capital, we are able to ultimately prevent an exacerbation or perhaps an adverse event that might take you to the hospital.
Can you talk about the value-based care?
I always say, you know, value-based care benefits from both touch and tech. And so in this regard, the technology has a role to play, you know, in all of this. You know, this idea of having a high touch experience for those people that are on the sicker side of the spectrum, that requires a lot of coordination between a lot of different types of clinical stakeholders.
I can see how, from a patient perspective, first of all, this is not only good news in terms of outcomes, but there's a real hunger, you know, for access to medicine.
I think there are a lot of opportunities to look at other types of kind of modalities of AI to really take the data that we are seeing on patients and to make sense of it, and hopefully to get to a place where we can develop really personalized and precise care plans for them.
Yeah, that's a great vision. And it's so encouraging to hear that there's already tried and true methods for encouraging patient engagement, of course.
So we really have to kind of think about this as an ecosystem and to foster kind of an environment in which these entrepreneurs or, you know, potential entrepreneurs will be successful.
All right, welcome back to the Biomedical Frontiers podcast. And this is the last podcast of this season, season one. So we are so grateful for everybody who has been listening to our first season of Biomedical Frontiers. Today, we're going to be talking about the evolution of healthcare delivery and how AI is changing heart health with Dr. Mark Hansen. Mark Hansen is the co-founder, advisor, and former chief product and AI officer at Heartbeat Health, a venture-backed healthcare technology startup focused on delivering high-tech enabled cardiovascular care at scale nationwide. Before starting Heartbeat Health, Mark also founded BeClose, a digital healthcare company that uses Internet of Things devices and AI-powered services to promote healthy, independent living at home, which has merged into Alarm.com. So that's a huge deal. And where he served as the head of the platform and health innovations during their IPO. So a lot of amazing experience in your background, Mark. But I also want to note a couple things for our UVA audience. He is a longtime board member of the University of Virginia School of Engineering and Applied Science Entrepreneurship Advisory Board, and he's a resource to other entrepreneurs at the university, and he's an adjunct associate professor at the George Washington University of School of Medicine and Health Sciences and an angel investor and advisor to numerous health tech startups. Mark, it's so exciting to have you on this podcast.
Dasha, thanks for having me. Certainly very honored and humbled to be part of such a great group of guests that you've had. And I've been listening to the past few episodes, and I've been really, really impressed with not only the production quality, but the great content that you're putting out. So really, really sort of grateful to be part of this group.
Well, this is such an interesting approach to talk about in terms of healthcare innovation, because we've talked a lot about more like devices and technologies that are diagnostic or treatment related. And this is really about care delivery. And so I think this is one of the areas where we're going to have to get into with a lot of depth. But first, I want to get a little bit of a background on you. So could you share a little bit on your PhD at the university, the wireless monitoring diagnostic devices that you were researching and helping build, and what attracted you to go into this field?
That's a great question. So, you know, as I've gotten older, I've come to embrace this idea of both intention and serendipity when it comes to finding your path. And, you know, when I was an undergrad at UVA, I was probably taking what I would consider a breadth-first approach to finding myself in college. So dabbling in a lot of different subject matter, really trying to understand what I enjoyed doing, what I didn't, trying to meet different people in different areas. And I think the university was a great place for that to happen. But I think what I did really become interested in, as you know, I was wrapping up my undergrad time, was mission-driven work. The idea of trying to find ways to drive positive impact societally through the work that I was doing. I didn't envision myself as a graduate student researcher at the university by any means. When I was coming out of school, I was thinking, oh, I'll go get an engineering job and start my career there. But it was a challenging time. The dot-com bubble had recently burst, and there were fewer opportunities for graduating engineers. And so it really focused my lens back on perhaps, gaining a little bit more knowledge, really trying to understand maybe what I wanted to try to do within subject matter. So as I was wrapping up, I took a class with John Locke, who at the time was an assistant professor in his second year at the university. And afterwards, he mentioned to me that he was looking for students to help him over the summer, both revamping the curriculum of the class I just took, which I enjoyed, but also beginning to explore a cross-disciplinary focus between electrical engineering and medicine. And he was very honest. He said he didn't have, significant funding in the area. It was very much a blank slate. But those things were really, really appealing to me. The idea of really trying to identify fundamental problems that we could attack at that boundary or that intersection, identifying ways that we could validate that problem, and ultimately try to solve those problems that would affect, hopefully positively, the lives of many patients. And so that was really got me into this space. I think now, like retrospectively looking back, that was absolutely the right move for me. Not only was John a great graduate advisor for me, but, over the course of about 6.5 years, he became a great mentor to me as well. And so certainly really cherished that time, took away a lot of lessons from that. And I think it really shaped me positively.
What's one particular lesson that stands out to you that's you've taken with you into your career as an entrepreneur as well?
So maybe there's probably a number of lessons. I think the first, is to find amazing, talented people to work with, who you want to work with. John really promoted this idea of cross-disciplinary research in the biomedical domain. And he felt that would yield, really transformative solutions. The idea of taking sort of independent thought in one domain and bringing it to another would express creativity in a way that perhaps hadn't been seen before. And I think he was right in that. He's very convicted in that idea. But that also meant we had to bring together a team of very diverse individuals with different talents and different perspectives. And for me, really sort of seeing that team build and ultimately getting to work with, folks on the medical side of the school or, other researchers in other disciplines was an important lesson for me. Because at the end of the day, in almost any venture that you work in, you're going to have to find really talented, amazing people to work with. And if you like working with them, it just makes work so much more delightful. So, that's one lesson. I think another lesson that he taught me was to attack research from first principles, really get to the root of the problem so that you understand that you're solving something, at its very basic level, fundamental level. And so that was important for us. It's a lesson that I think applies very much to startups as well. We were very evidence-based. Obviously, we're a graduate research group, and we were trying to demonstrate efficacy of our approach along the way. But what was also important was to be iterative. You don't have to solve the whole problem all at once. You can sort of nibble off pieces of it, see that you're trending in the right direction, and ultimately, take a large problem and break it down into its constituent parts and solve those parts. And other things that I think John, perhaps taught me that, were maybe not sort of as qualitative or research-based or objective. The first was to be empathetic to the experience of healthcare. We're obviously working in deep, engineering, kind of focused domains or in clinical domains. And you oftentimes lose sight of the fact that patients at the end of the day are experiencing the solutions or the products that we're putting into the field. And so the idea to really think about the experience from, their perspective and to make sure that they're having a good experience was something that we really tried to infuse into almost everything that we were doing. And I think the final lesson I learned was the importance of storytelling. At the end of the day, you've got to be able to communicate the work that you're doing in a way that not only sort of helps to like really build interest in the area and help, you know, helps us recruit new talent to our group, but also really helps in attracting funding into the work that we were doing as well. So we got really good at really telling our story and ultimately in a way that was, you know, I think authentic and you know, outcome driven. And I think that really helped us go from that blank slate that I discussed earlier to what became a really major research initiative at the university.
And where along that journey did you feel that, oh, I'm going to be an entrepreneur? Because it looks like you basically, that's what you've done. You didn't go pursue after that corporate jobs or job just researching. It seems like you've just jumped it right in. So
I've always had like an inkling that I wanted to pursue entrepreneurship. My grandfather was a small business owner, a grocer in a small town. And I remember when I was little, I would always look up to that idea of, wow, you own this business, you help to run the business. That's so cool. So I've had that implanted from a really early stage. I would say, you know, what kind of got that going for me, you know, in undergrad, you know, I was obviously surrounded by different individuals that were starting to explore entrepreneurship, certainly earlier than I was. And, you know, we had one example of that as I was entering grad school in Reddit. And, you know, both Alexis and Steve from the engineering school, starting Reddit. So I was able to see their journey. And while, you know, I wasn't part of Reddit or part of their experience, I was able to at least live, you know, kind of vicariously through a lot of the experiences that they were having through Y Combinator and whatnot. And I was also surrounded with other individuals, Zach Buckner in particular, who started Relay Foods in Charlottesville, was a friend of mine. And so I was able to see some of the early parts of his journey. But in grad school, you know, John was very patient with me and I think understanding of my interest and desire to learn more about entrepreneurship. And as I mentioned, I dabbled quite a bit in different subject matter in undergrad. I did a little bit of that in grad school too, maybe not quite as much, but I took several jaunts over to Darden to try to understand what people over there were working on. Along the way, with Ian Ayers and Sarah Cruz, I started an organization called the E-Society, which was really the intent of that was to bring entrepreneurs from across the university together and to try to understand not only their perspectives, but what they were working on and even just, you know, matchmake a little bit. If there was a startup founded in, you know, the university, like maybe bring other people into that startup. So we grew that from a small organization to what became a fairly large organization across the university. And I also had a startup in grad school as well called Energy Guardian that I started with Gordon Avery and in the energy management space, residential space. So I was able to dabble a little bit and explore different pursuits. And I think that not only was the environment great, but, you know, obviously John being understanding of the need that I had to really explore that was what I needed at the time.
So fast forwarding now, the last few years, you have been building Heartbeat Health, your new company, and hearts are obviously important. And heart disease is one of the top killers of Americans. And I think you, in our previous conversation, you mentioned that the budget for managing heart health in the United States is the same as the DOD budget, which is obviously a very big number. So what is the specific problem? I mean, it sounds like such a amorphous, large, multi-year challenge, even on an individual patient level, but at a societal level, very, very big problem. What specifically are you working to impact with Heartbeat Health?
You're absolutely right. The scale of cardiovascular conditions and cardiovascular disease, specifically in the United States, is enormous. It's what also attracted me to the space. I felt that there weren't enough people working in cardiovascular care to really promote the type of impact that we should be seeing going forward. You know, just to give you a few numbers, cardiovascular conditions, just, you know, kind of writ large, affect nearly 48% of Americans. So that's a flip of a coin. So literally, if you're, you know, in a large room, almost every other person probably is managing some sort of cardiovascular condition. 1 in 3 deaths are directly attributable to cardiovascular disease. 15% of all U.S. healthcare spend is related to cardiovascular care. And to the number that you quoted earlier, it's estimated that by 2030, about $1 trillion will be spent on the total cost of cardiovascular healthcare in the United States, which is definitely on the same order of magnitude as our defense budget. So it's a today, well, you might look at that and say, this is an almost intractable problem, both fiscally for, you know, kind of our government trying to manage that, but also at a societal level, it impacts so many people. It leads to such poor outcomes, such poor experiences in the healthcare system. And so, you know, I felt like, hey, if I'm going to apply my, you know, my energy to a problem, let's find a really big problem to solve here. And certainly cardiovascular care meets a lot of those issues that we talked about. And it's certainly a major condition societally that we should be focused on. You know, I think what we learned as well in the early part of Heartbeat, as we were really trying to understand not only the scope of the problem, but specifically get into the first principles of the problem, is that people that are managing their cardiovascular conditions, they're not getting the right care at the right place at the right time. And that's a common phrase or a mantra that you'll hear in value-based care. But in particular, in cardiovascular care, there are a lot of people that are even just, you know, walking around daily that have undiagnosed conditions that they probably should be getting specialty care for. And so just knowing that and knowing that the bar is somewhat lower and that you can really improve the lives of people even by just identifying cardiovascular conditions for them and helping them get on a path to treatment is something that really attracted me to this space.
So are you saying that from a treatment perspective, there's actually a lot out there, but that people don't know that they are on a path to needing that treatment, and that's the area where you see the greatest impact possible right now?
Yeah, I heard a quote, I get this is a little while ago. I think somebody had said that the miracle of modern medicine is medicine. And, you know, there are a lot of great pharmacotherapies already available to people with cardiovascular conditions that can not only mitigate their risk factors, but also mitigate the potential of having, you know, an exacerbation of their condition or perhaps even a hospitalization that's a result of a, you know, an acute issue. And so beyond just the medicine, we have a lot of great diagnostic technologies today that weren't around even 30 or 40 years ago that we have to identify conditions and ultimately get people into targeted therapies. So, you know, absolutely, there's a lot that we can do if we can not only just identify individuals, but we can help them create a care plan and track the progression of their progress and of the therapy that they're, you know, undergoing. And then finally, you know, to ensure that continuously they're getting the type of care that they need at the level of, you know, kind of frequency and whatnot that they need it. So I think we're just starting to scratch the surface of this. And, you know, I think there's a much larger shift in the United States right now from a fee-for-service model, where you're literally just paying for a transaction with the clinician. So you go to the doctor, beyond the co-pays and balance pays or whatnot, you're really just paying for that particular encounter that you just had with your physician, to another model, which is a value-based care model, which really rewards clinicians and the entire healthcare system for better outcomes and quality of care. And that's an important transition that we need to make. And, you know, Heartbeat is not yet a value-based care organization, but I think they're value-seeking in that they're really trying to bring, you know, kind of a lens onto this problem that that ultimately drives better outcomes.
So I want to dig into a particular paper that you and the Heartbeat Health team had published, which is so intriguing and has very interesting results. So the paper is called The Impact of Virtual Cardiology Program for Post-Discharge Patients with Cardiovascular Disease, a Randomized Clinical Trial. And I just want to know, and we will dig into this as well, which is you guys are producing clinical trials as a delivery sort of telehealth organization. So that's really interesting to poke into a little bit as well. But here is kind of the results summarized. The program led to a reduction in all-cause and cardiac readmissions. So 44% reduction in all-cause readmissions, 53% reduction in cardiac readmission. And this was 8 out of 95 cardiac readmissions in the intervention group versus 17 in the out of 95 in the control group. So this was statistically significant. You had a large number of people in the study. And just as a note that you guys have in the data, $16,000 per readmission. So in addition to the human cost of the complications and the time lost and the fear and the worry, that's also significant economic cost. So let's first talk a little bit about the design of the study and what you guys learned primarily from that experience.
Yeah, so I think what's really interesting in this particular study, and credit goes to you know, the investigators in our company. You had brought up an earlier question about the just the idea of, you know, kind of a commercial entity like Heartbeat, a startup, you know, conducting fundamental research to be evidence based. And that's a core tenet of, you know, I think a lot of digital and you know and health tech companies in our space. And part of that reason is that we have to demonstrate not only efficacy of our approach, but we have to also pay, you know, demonstrate patient safety as well. So in particular, in this study, I think what it's really getting at is a larger theme, which is that there is a predictable rate of reduction of high cost events when you actually invest in preventative care, and you also invest in the therapy as well, and into ensuring that the patient is adherent to those therapies as they're beginning to go through that. And we found that, you know, that you can think about this, you know, from an economic standpoint, there's an actual ROI on really investing in this type of preventative or proactive care. And we found that, you know, it can be 3x in some cases and as high as 9x in other cases. So while you do have to put a little bit more effort and human capital, just, you know, we're a high touch experience. Oftentimes we have our MAs or nurse practitioners, you know, actually interfacing with patients, ensuring that, you know, they're moving through their therapies, that we're not seeing anything that, that as they're, you know, kind of undergoing their therapy that would cause us concern or that would suggest that we need to titrate their therapy. So we have that invested human capital and those touch points and whatnot. What we're also demonstrating, though, is we are able to ultimately prevent an exacerbation or perhaps an adverse event that might take you to the hospital. And you know, I think what we've seen is the economics for that are quite compelling. Like even just a single hospitalization, I think the Journal of American College of Cardiology had sort of done a study on this, and it was around 13,000 to 14,000 with a plus or minus 24,000 for an airbound there. But you know, I think it can be really high. So as high as, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 for a needy inpatient admission. Whereas, you know, the cost of doing some of these touch points with the right level of clinician is de minimis to that. And so we are I think what we're beginning to demonstrate here is you do have to invest a bit. You have to invest in that that higher touch experience to ensure ultimately that we can take those people that are at the highest risk for having these adverse cardiac events, getting them managed earlier, making sure that as they're managing it, managing their own conditions, that they're adherent to the clinical guidelines that we are ultimately incorporating into their care plans. And when you do that, ultimately you can demonstrate, you know, a really, really good return. And, you know, we do have to think about both the outcomes, but the economics as well. Because at the end of the day, we need to make sure that our healthcare system, as a whole is delivering the type of care that we all expect from a quality standpoint, but also from a value standpoint so that it can be solvent many generations into the future. And that's ultimately, I think the small part that companies like ours have to play in the larger ecosystem.
I want to dig in a little bit more into the same paper. So one of the things that is obvious in terms of the process, the intervention group, which received the telehealth visits through Heartbeat Health, they had an average of 10 visits over, I think it was maybe 90 days or so, versus it said unknown on the control group, but I'm guessing no televisits and maybe one follow-up visit. And then the other thing was the average number of medication changes. And so the intervention group had an average of 4 medication changes and versus NA in the control group. So could it be that, I mean, is that just, that basically explains it, that the people were on the wrong medication and there was no follow-up or measurements taken, or is there something deeper going on as well in terms of the visits?
So, you know, one thing that's important to note here is that oftentimes I've seen that we say things like guideline-directed therapy are the ways to proceed in terms of optimizing patient care. And I would tend to agree with that. There's a lot of time in our space in particular, the American College of Cardiology, in addition to the AMA, put out guidelines on how to actually address specific courses of care for people with heart disease or other conditions. And those guidelines are driven by, you know, a real rigorous meta-analysis of lots and lots of clinical evidence, you know, across the literature. And so literally years and years of research are synthesized and a determination is made that, you know, in many cases, if we, you know, or for this particular case, if we apply a certain therapy to this patient that presents in a certain way, we are going to ensure that we are optimizing their therapeutic outcome. And so, you know, even if we just boil away all the complexity of the healthcare system and the economics of that and the technology and whatnot, if we would just let our clinicians practice guideline-directed care, we would see tremendous benefits. But there's a lot of difficulty in just doing that. And, you know, that was, I think, an important lesson for me to learn early on as we really got into treating patients. And I'll give you some, you know, simple examples. A lot of the actual guidelines require that you have things like, you know, kind of an understanding of their clinical risk factors. And, you know, you need their clinical record even, and just, you know, having access to diagnostics. And what we were finding often is that patients were showing up at our front door. We didn't have a whole lot of information on their specific clinical condition. You know, we were having to like really onboard them or like, you know, do our clinical intake all over again. And so that creates a lot of redundancy. It means that our clinicians can't practice that guideline-directed care from, you know, time zero moving forward. We have to kind of work, you know, backwards a little bit and make sure that the patient is presented to that clinician in a way that the clinician can be productive. So for us, what we really tried to do was to set up a system in which not only could we actually ensure that we could practice that guideline-directed medicine, but that we could let our specialists, our cardiologists, actually practice in a way that they're used to practicing. And often what that means is that, you know, they're looking at the patient, they're observing what is actually happening from an outcome perspective with that patient on the ground, you know, momentarily. And as, you know, as that patient is changing, especially in a post-acute discharge setting, you're going to have patients that change, you know, pretty quickly. They're being aggressive in a guideline-directed way with the therapy and making sure that they're titrating the medication. So it's not that they're on the wrong medication. It's oftentimes that they're changing the dosage of that medication, or they're really trying to lock in on what is going to drive that positive impact, that positive outcome for the patient. And what we found is in the sickest populations, you know, especially those that might be post-acute discharge patients, we oftentimes have to do that with higher touch and at a higher frequency. We have to check in on them weekly or sometimes multiple times a week and make sure that they're actually taking their medications, that they're not experiencing side effects from those medications, and that we're seeing an improvement in their condition. And so that's really why, you know, in this particular population, we were meeting with those patients so frequently, and so that we were also titrating their therapies, you know, at such a granular level to ensure that they would have that good outcome. And that was ultimately driven by the guidelines. You know, our clinicians do like to practice against our guidelines. I mean, I think that's a, you know, in general, most clinicians do. And so, and, you know, I think what the wrapper that, you know, Heartbeat has that put around that care is to ensure that not only are we at information parity for that patient across our whole team, we're care coordinated across the team. We're, you know, we're actually, you know, sharing what's happening with that individual so that we can really be on the ground with them and make sure that they are, you know, getting the type of therapy that's improving their situation. There is a cost to that. And that earlier conversation that we had around, you know, ROI, we have to factor that in. And so this type of high touch is not for everyone. But in this particular patient population, I think what we were able to demonstrate is for those people that do have an expressed higher risk of an exacerbating event or perhaps rehospitalization, it oftentimes makes a lot of sense for us to use that type of care in order to make sure that they have, you know, the outcome that they want.
So I can see how, from a patient perspective, first of all, this is not only good news in terms of outcomes, but there's a real hunger, you know, for access to medicine. And I think more and more people are experiencing longer wait times, and the doctor shortage, the nurse shortage are consistent headlines. And particularly after COVID, it's been really kind of revealed just how much of churn and complexity there is to even running these healthcare systems, the doctors being burned out, et cetera. So from a patient perspective, I think very clear value on so many levels, not just the cost, but their own lives at stake and the kind of care that they would be looking for. But what about from the administration or doctor side of things? Is this sort of intervention group that's getting to see the doctor 10 times potentially, is that taking away from care in person or how do we staff that availability?
So that's a really good question. I think one of the important aspects that we have to really start to become comfortable with in the healthcare system is to ensure that we are directing patients to the level of care that's appropriate to their presentation. Not every patient needs to see a cardiologist. That's pretty obvious. A cardiologist is a specialist, and you know they're focused on specifically cardiovascular events that are not being well managed, usually in a primary care setting, or that are beyond a primary care setting. And you know, I think in the case of you know that we were talking about with the high touch points, you know, required to ensure success of a care plan like that we discussed with that the cohort, it makes sometimes more sense to put that individual in front of a nurse or a nurse practitioner or a PA or sometimes even a medical assistant to capture that information. It you know, and what we can do is we can assess that that feedback that we're receiving from the patient. And we can escalate if necessary to, let's say, an internist or you know a cardiologist if necessary, and that ensures also that we're being a lot more efficient in how we're utilizing resources. So we certainly can't put a cardiologist on every single patient's touch point. If we did that, I think we would have you know kind of real capacity constraints. We already have a massive capacity constraint, by the way. There's about 25 to 30,000 practicing cardiologists, and it's estimated as many as 100 million people may need to actually be cared for by cardiologists. So this is, you know, this is a major, major focal point for a lot of people that are thinking about clinical policy. But we have to be smart about the type of people and the level of training that we're putting on these individuals. Our chief medical officer at Heartbeat often has this saying. She says, you know, we need to make sure that every person in our organization is practicing at the top of their license. So we don't have those individuals like a cardiologist perhaps doing just a routine check-in, right? Because that would be probably an inefficient use of their time. So we built a system at Heartbeat that directs patients to the level of care that they need and, you know, looks at things like, hey, is this a routine touch point or is this something where we do need to have perhaps a cardiologist overseeing this or directly interfacing with the patient on? And it gets that particular, we call this, you know, a job. Basically, it's a piece of work that has to be done for that patient. It gets that job to the right clinician. And so from a provider standpoint, what it means too is that, you know, when they're practicing at the top of their license, they feel good. They're not having to do that type of work that they know is inefficient for them from, you know, kind of a financial standpoint, but it also means that they're able to attack problems at the level that they are trained to attack. And so, you know, in our setting, as I mentioned earlier, we want our cardiologists to take these risk factors, attack them aggressively in a modern guideline-directed sense. And, you know, if we're having them do a routine visit, obviously that's not that's going to take time away from you know from having them work with a patient that really needs their attention at the moment.
So I saw AI in one of your titles related to Heartbeat Health. How are you guys incorporating AI techniques into the work, and what is it enabling Heartbeat Health to do that without AI you wouldn't be able to achieve?
Yeah, so AI has become this like you know kind of hot touch point, I think, for everyone. There's a lot of potential. There's, you know, there's certainly, you know, I think we're in a really frothy moment in history right now where, you know, almost if you attach AI to anything, it seems like the valuation is doubled or tripled overnight. But, you know, I think in cardiology, there's a number of different areas where AI can be really, really helpful. And then the first is actually identifying the types of patients that will benefit most from seeing a specialist. We see this quite a bit. Oftentimes in a primary care setting, patients aren't referred up to, you know, specialty care, whether it's cardiology or whatnot. Perhaps because, you know, the primary care physicians are oftentimes busy, but they're also, you know, maybe they don't understand fully the full context of that patient. And maybe they don't realize at any given moment, the patient might be actually experiencing a cardiovascular issue and it's buried deep in their clinical record or, you know, their EMR record. And it just hasn't been surfaced for that clinician's attention. And you know, patients in this regard do have to be advocates, by the way, for their own health. But it's very easy to miss patients that would benefit from a specialty encounter or, you know, a course of care. And, you know, AI has a tremendous ability to sort through lots and lots of data, whether it's clinical records, claims records, or whatnot, and then identify patients who might be really good candidates to receive better care in a specialty setting like Heartbeat. And so that's the first place that AI can be really useful. In fact, we apply a lot of different techniques to actually help organizations that we work with identify the right types of patients to bring into our practice setting. And, you know, that's been really helpful for us. The second area is actually in the diagnostic evaluation of that patient. So there's a lot of really, really sort of interesting work that's been done in the diagnostic space. You know, we work with a number of different companies that are working on everything from wearable rhythm monitors to, you know, coronary computed, you know, tomography and angiography to, you know, even, you know, looking at like, sort of the vascular science of things. And then even on the consumer side, there's a ton of wearables now. You know, everyone has seen the Apple Watch and Fitbits, and we work with an organization called Withings that is doing a lot of great work on the clinical space with consumer wearables. But that data ultimately has to be processed, and it has to take into consideration the clinical context of that patient in order for us to better understand, you know, does this patient have a diagnosis that perhaps is undiagnosed? And do we need to like run, you know, further diagnostics to validate that? And so there's a lot of work that's being done to combine the data from these new types of devices and modalities with the clinical record to ultimately determine if that patient either has an express diagnosis or if they're at risk for a condition and they should be receiving, you know, further follow-up care. I think, you know, the other areas, you know, that we look at are, you know, tracking and evaluating the progress of that patient. And there's a lot of really interesting work that's, you know, in the biomarker space that evaluates like, where is the patient sort of heading? Is their risk increasing or decreasing for an adverse event? Is there risk of hospitalization potentially increasing or decreasing? So there's a lot of interesting, you know, just direct biomarkers, but even these synthetic biomarkers that are coming available now that combine data from a number of different sources to better assess the patient. All of these areas, I think, are you know, kind of areas in which AI has a tremendous opportunity to affect some change. And it's not just the large language models. I think everyone is trying to apply ChatGPT or Anthropic's model to almost everything. I think there are a lot of opportunities to look at other types of you know, kind of modalities of AI to really take the data that we are seeing on patients and to make sense of it, and hopefully to get to a place where we can develop really personalized and precise care plans for them.
Well, that's and that's also going back a little bit into your wearables, sensory devices, and kind of the evolution of what you can even bring into a person's home or a person's life in order to gather more data, kind of going back to your PhD roots. I just, as a kind of wrap-up question on the Heartbeat Health, just wondering what you've seen as the most impressive technologies when it comes to the wearable sort of health at home market and where you see that going in the next few years.
So I think there's a lot of work that's being done in general in the wearable space, and that gives me a lot of hope. I think one of the, you know, if there's a theme that we can kind of take away, it's that continuous data in particular, even if it's at like a lower resolution or, you know, kind of a, you know, less precise, you know, kind of capture modality, is actually more beneficial at times than really sort of precise but pinpoint episodic data. So I'll give you a simple example. We work with a company called iRhythm that has a wearable single lead ECG patch. And they typically a patient will wear this patch over the course of about 2 weeks. So you get 2 weeks of continuous heart rhythm data. And, you know, you can also go into a clinic and you can get a 12 lead ECG applied, you know, over the course of a few minutes. A technician will work with you to apply all the leads. You're going to get really, really, you know, high precision data across all those 12 leads. And you're going to be able to measure a lot more of the electrical characteristic of the heart itself. But it is very sort of episodic. It's in a very narrow time window. If you're a patient that potentially has atrial fibrillation, and we're trying to capture that particular AFib event, it's far more likely that if we were to actually put that heart rhythm wearable patch on you, like a device like an iRhythm patch, that we'd be able to catch it because it's measuring continuously over the course of those 2 weeks versus, you know, being in the clinic at the very moment that, you know, you're having an AFib event and catching it on the 12 lead ECG. So that theme can be applied to a lot of different sensed areas in the cardiovascular care and across all of healthcare in general. So I'm really hopeful that as we begin to evolve the devices that you see in the clinical space, but also in the commercial, just, you know, things like Apple Watches and Fitbits in that space, that we'll have a lot more raw data to work with. We'll be capturing specific events of interest that future AI algorithms will be able to like actually extract. So we'll be able to pull that signal from all of the noise of all the data and then get that patient to the right type of care. I think that is like really kind of the holy grail for you know, the wearable space. And it's been something I think that we've all been, you know, really pushing for. Heartbeat does that today. We have an AFib management program that we stood up with iRhythm. It was called Know Your Rhythm. And, you know, it's a really important program. You know, things like arrhythmias like AFib can lead to a lot of downstream devastating consequences, so like stroke or heart failure. So finding it early is really important. And, you know, just like we were speaking about earlier, there's a lot of targeted therapies and treatments that can help if you find these particular conditions early. So not only identifying those people that are at, you know, kind of the right profile for a rhythm monitor, but then, you know, really identifying that that person has had an AFib event early can mean that we can actually apply an early therapy, prevent something like a stroke or heart failure from happening. And then perhaps the downstream consequences of hospitalization, you know, impacts to quality of life and whatnot. So, you know, I'm really hopeful in particular at the larger space of wearables. And I think there's, you know, I don't think there's any one device that I get super excited with, but I think, you know, just the tide of momentum that we're seeing with all these wearables beginning to, enter the market is really important. Obviously, there's a lot of work to be done to take the data from these wearables and then rigorously study that data to determine whether or not it's predictive for a whole number of different, you know, health conditions or perhaps it might even be useful in other contexts. So we still have a lot of work to do. I think, you know, we're just at the tip of the iceberg when we talk about AI. And so I'm really excited to see kind of the breadth of data that we're seeing now. But I know that means that we have a lot of work ahead of us to ultimately be rigorous and processing and finding ways to make that data useful.
Is there any additional innovation that's needed on the devices side? Sounds like there's a lot that needs to be done on the data side, but to bring that kind of wearables, more than just fitness trackers, are really useful over many years and predictive in their nature.
There's a lot of vitals that are just difficult to capture that if we could do it continuously, would be really helpful for us. I think the obvious one is something like blood pressure. And I know there's a lot of work that's happening. There are devices on the market that do some level of continuous BP monitoring, but, you know, they're oftentimes not at a consumer level yet, or they're not as mature as some of the devices that are doing, you know, rhythm monitoring or, you know, even ECG. So I'm particularly hopeful to open up the entire space of vitals that you would typically see measured, you know, in a clinical setting, made continuous, body worn, and you know, ultimately perhaps worn over a number of days, if not weeks, because I think that'll open up a lot of investigative, you know, benefit into what actually is happening with a lot of different people. And so, you know, there's been a ton of work, not only in how you actually sense that, but even in different, you know, obviously there's like pulse wave velocity. There's a lot of different ways that you can measure continuously blood pressure. And I think we're going to see that's just, again, this is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of sensing potential. We're seeing a lot, you know, of advancements in, you know, in battery technology. Like I think the implantable space has greatly benefited from that. When I was in grad school, we were just seeing the first lithium and lithium polymer chemistry batteries come onto the market. And so huge capacity, huge energy density in a relatively small form factor. And that's only continued. I mean, you're seeing, you know, the benefits of that today in a lot of these body-worn devices and implantables. There's been huge improvements in wireless technology. So, you know, Bluetooth, obviously, like 20 years ago, and again, when I was in grad school, that was kind of a nascent technology. But there's a lot more capability to get data off body continuously. So even today, a lot of the wearables are storing that data on wearable, and you have to literally take, you know, the wearable off, you know, and when you're syncing the device or charging it, that's when you're getting the data stream. But there are technologies now that are beginning to wirelessly stream what I would consider very clinically relevant biomarkers, you know, continuously. And so that starts to become really interesting, especially if you're doing like remote patient monitoring or anything that requires continuous, like real-time monitoring of a patient. We're seeing a concerted effort to design really ultra low power or low power devices that that can take advantage of, you know, new architectures for microcontrollers and mixed signal processors. That means that, you know, even with the existing battery technology, we're going to get much longer battery lives. So we're going to see a lot of improvement in the ability to wear these devices. I sometimes even just get annoyed that I have to take my Apple Watch off at night to charge it, because I'm like, I'm losing valuable data from when I'm sleeping. But, you know, I think we'll start to see a lot more improvement in that area. There's a lot of medical domain, you know, innovations as well. Targeted therapies. I worked on a project in grad school where we were helping to characterize, you know, the movement to help neurosurgeons better target their deep brain stimulation. So there was, you know, there's a lot of targeted therapies that are coming online that really show benefit if you can identify the right patients that make sense for that. So when you combine really all of that, you know, that sort of improvement, that innovation that's happening in the space, I think what we'll see over the next decade is that we'll start to rely more and more on this continuous data that we're capturing oftentimes in the patient's natural setting, whether it's at home or at work or whatnot, than the clinical data that we're today sort of, you know, capturing episodically the few times of year that you go into a clinical setting. And I am hopeful that that will ultimately yield, you know, better identification of patients who have, you know, undiagnosed issues. It will yield, you know, a better targeting of therapies that we're beginning to see come onto the market. And ultimately, it'll get the patient more engaged with their own care. And this is an area that I've been really passionate about. I fundamentally believe that we need to be better about educating patients, but really advocating for patients to be engaged in their own care. Because ultimately, if you can share that information with the patient and have them be stewards of their own care, they're going to promote health benefits perhaps even more efficiently than any clinical worker, you know, in our space. And so we really have to figure out how to bring that patient into their own care. And I think wearables play a big role in that.
Yeah. So one other innovation that you've mentioned as it comes to heartbeat health and also evolution of our healthcare delivery is accountability-based care or value-based care models. And so that's just as important as the devices side of innovation, because obviously we have a lot of suffering in our healthcare system that isn't even related to the condition that's being treated, from long wait times to doctor, nurse burnout, administration staff that's just, you know, getting rushed around, information that's siloed that nobody knows where to get it. So it's a lot there that needs to be innovated as well. So can you talk about the value-based care? What is that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So value-based care is really about shifting a focus from just gross volume of services that we're providing to our patients to the quality and outcomes of care that the patient's receiving. And so it's a mindset shift, and it's also a system shift. And, you know, and as a result, it becomes a quite, you know, challenging thing to when you're thinking about big changes like this. But the basic idea is to move us away from this transactional model that we were talking about earlier, and get us to a place where we're rewarding our providers for providing fundamentally high quality care that's efficiently delivered. And so there's a few major differences between value-based care and, you know, kind of our traditional fee-for-service care. And so the first thing, which kind of ties us back into our earlier conversation, is this is patient-centered. So ultimately, the care is tailored really to the individual needs of the patient. And so as opposed to really thinking about managing, you know, kind of a large volume of services and just kind of creating a factory and a churn of patients, it's really about identifying, hey, does this particular patient need a specific type of care to efficiently produce an outcome that we really want to see. You know, the second thing is it's really about care coordination. So again, we talked a bit about, you know, this idea of having a high touch experience for those people that are on the sicker side of the spectrum. That requires a lot of coordination between a lot of different types of clinical stakeholders. And, you know, that's important for us, but it also means that we have to have parity of information with the, you know, with all of the clinical team members and with the patient's entire clinical context. So we really need to understand, you know, what has happened with that patient in the past, what's currently going on with the patient today, so that we're all on the same page. It also means that we can reduce things like redundant diagnostics that are oftentimes ordered for patients. And so overall, it leads to a much better experience. That does require some technology. So, you know, I always say, you know, value-based care benefits from both touch and tech. And so in this regard, the technology, you know, whether it's, you know, better use of the patient's electronic medical record, use of things like, you know, telemedicine, or even just better, you know, understanding of the actual data itself from that patient, really understanding the insights that we can generate from that. Technology has a role to play, you know, in all of this. And, you know, another theme here is patient engagement. We talked about like really having the patient be an advocate for their care, but to be really engaged in their own care. We really need to encourage the patient to have involvement in their own care. And that's incredibly important. And what that looks like and how it's different from our traditional fee-for-service situation, we don't have this reactive nature of care as much. So today we oftentimes, you know, are treating patients well after they've, you know, exacerbated and they're perhaps even having an event or they're post having an event. And it just limits the options that you have for, you know, creating a good outcome for that patient. It also means that we're spending a lot more money on that patient because they have oftentimes been hospitalized already or they're going through, you know, several rounds of hospitalizations. We're seeing a lot of fragmentation today in our traditional fee-for-service environment. So you have, you know, different providers working very much in silos. Patients, you know, I think intuitively have experienced this where, you know, perhaps you're referred to a specialist and that specialist is literally asking you the same questions that your primary care doctor asked you because they haven't received your full context in your, you know, electronic medical record. They haven't had time to digest it or understand it yet. So, you know, oftentimes we're seeing that fragmentation. We feel it in that siloing. And we know that that's leading to inefficiency and it absolutely is, you know, very inefficient. And, you know, I think the other thing here is that, you know, the scope of what providers are focusing on in a kind of that fragmented fee-for-service model is often much smaller. So they're not looking holistically at the patient and trying to determine what are the most efficient ways that we can get to managing this patient's comorbidities. So if you have a patient that's managing, for example, CKD and heart disease, chronic kidney disease, you may want to take a different course of care than if you were independently managing both of those conditions. And so really making sure that, again, bringing all those entities together under the same, kind of the same information umbrella is important as it relates to the care. So those are all kind of key enablers of value-based medicine. It's very challenging in that much of our healthcare infrastructure, the technologies that we use, the processes that we are deploying, are built for that transactional, high-volume, fee-for-service type environment. So it requires an almost full system change to get to value-based medicine. And that's really why it's been so challenging to date. There are a lot of really encouraging developments, however, whether you look at economic models that really, push this forward, whether it's ACOs or MA plans that are already in market that are really starting to demonstrate, really good outcomes at efficient costs. You are also finding a lot of organizations like Heartbeat that are value seeking. So Heartbeat works with a number of very large value-based care providers or provider groups, and enables cardiology care to happen in these large primary care settings because we're doing it in such an efficient way. We are driving a lot of those benefits, like the care coordination, like the actual technology use and the use of telehealth, and really bring together kind of all the data on the patient and ultimately deriving insight from that data. So you can get really, really close to being a value-based care organization without necessarily having kind of that incentivized payment model that's overlaid on many of the organizations. So that contract, essentially. So I'm really, I think hopeful, and I think value-based care has been talked about probably for 15 to 20 years, it seems. I think that's about right. And I think, we're finally getting over the hump. All of the actual key enablers of value-based care are now lining up. And so it's really our job, probably over the next 5 to 10 years, to begin to bring value-based care to a scaled setting all across the country. And there are a lot of organizations that have large cohorts of patients already managed there, but we don't see that really nationwide yet. And I think you'll begin to see that over the next 5 years. And I think, if we look back in 10 years, you'll see kind of pockets of fee-for-service, but I think the vast majority of providers will be working within value-based care arrangements.
It's really heartening to hear that this is already being tried and there's a lot of proof behind it. For me personally, I began getting familiar with this talking to you. And I think for many of our patients and providers, they might not be as familiar with this innovation that's going on in the background of the system. Can you describe maybe a particularly poignant example or something where you've seen real success and transformation, and also the story of what it takes to transform a healthcare system of some scale to be valuable, who all has to participate, what's required really, because it does sound like such a ambiguous, voluminous problem.
So we are working with a number of value-based care providers. So fortunately, we don't have the task of trying to convince a large healthcare system to try to, convert over to a value-based care organization. There are a lot of examples of systems that have, whether they've, taken some risk and actually, created like an ACO model, an accountable care organization, where they take some subset or, quite a few of their providers and put them into a different payment model that rewards quality of care. But, in our situation at Heartbeat, we were fortunate to find a number of really forward-seeking clinical entities that were already delivering value-based care at scale. And, there's a number that we work with that I think we publicly mentioned, organizations like Oak Street Health, for example, that have already demonstrated a lot of success in driving great outcomes at reasonable cost. And so in our situation, really, it's about finding ways to integrate the type of care that we provide, which is specialty care, with the type of care that, an organization like Oak Street provides, which is going to be more on the primary care side. Key capabilities that we have to put in place when we work with an organization like that are to first make sure that we are getting the right types of patients. So I know I sound like a broken record, but identifying, the right types of patients that would make sense in a setting like that to actually benefit from Heartbeat. Obviously, like, specialty care is going to be more expensive. So identifying the patients that are most at risk of having, like, for example, a cardiovascular event, and getting them to a organization like us is going to be really important. So that's where we have to ensure that we have some ability to help an organization like Oak Street identify the right types of patients that make sense for Heartbeat. Second, it's about putting the right types of diagnostics on those patients, or, you know, ordering the right types of diagnostics for those patients that ultimately will yield us, you know, the specific types of insights that we need as specialty care providers for the conditions that we are actually managing. So in that situation, you know, like whether it's, you know, echocardiograms or heart rhythm monitors or whatnot, ensuring that we're getting that diagnostic actually to that patient, ultimately, you know, determining if that patient has, through the interpretation of that diagnostic, a condition that we need to manage. And then the final piece of that is to ensure that we can translate back to that organization what the care plan is that is ultimately going to make that patient healthier. And in the case of like a collaboration like I just discussed, we oftentimes find that the actual care that's provided on a primary care level can really benefit from the insights that we derive at the specialty level. And so making sure that we can consultatively bring that information back to those primary care providers from our specialty providers and to give them insights into how they can better manage their patients so that they can prevent rehospitalization risk or hospitalization risk or exacerbation of the actual cardiovascular events that or cardiovascular conditions that those patients have is really important. And so those specific touch points between humans, between clinicians, are critical. So it requires a whole lot of infrastructure, as you might imagine, to work in that way. It also requires a whole lot of process. So, you know, a lot of coordination between people. And so building kind of the actual solution requires that we have, you know, the technology in place and really kind of our care coordination in place so that we can be efficient in how we deliver the care and to scale that care as well.
So is there some way that patients can advocate for value-based care? Because it does seem to, you know, ultimately be so valuable to the patient, and because their quality and their outcomes are considered in the payment model. So the incentive structure is really for them to get better, not to say that doctors don't want, of course they want patients to get better, but when you have at the topmost level different incentive structures, you start to get, you know, bureaucracies and things that impede that goal versus the goal being directly aligned with the patient's goal. How can patients advocate for this?
So, you know, you bring up a really interesting point, which is what we're seeing right now start to develop is that as a lot of these value-based care models begin to grow and scale, the human capital required to make them deliver the outcomes that are still beneficial and demonstrate that ROI that we discussed earlier that makes them compelling begins to erode a bit. So I don't think we as an industry have figured out yet how to scale these models quite as efficiently at the large scale as we can kind of in a smaller setting. And so that is a major challenge that we need to figure out. I do think there are a lot of places where we can leverage things like some of the data science innovations that are happening, our AI, automation, to drive, you know, in efficiencies of the actual human care that is being provided, or the human touch points that are provided. There are, I think, a lot of opportunities as well to better understand like what specifically is the patient's responsibility here, and I think that is, you know, critical for us moving forward. We oftentimes talk about a key determinant of successful value-based care programs being, you know, kind of the engagement of the patient. And oftentimes the payer entities that are actually funding the pilot studies in some of these models are specifically looking at, hey, is the patient engaged in this particular program? Because what we find is regardless of whether this is a value-based care model or a fee-for-service model, if the patient isn't engaged in their own care plan, it doesn't really matter like what specific, you know, model that we're actually utilizing with that patient. We're probably not going to see the type of result that the patient wants to see or that the system would benefit from. And so we need to really get patients to be much more involved in their care. And I think one of the things that we are beginning to see as a starting point for that is creating a shared information parity with that patient so that the information on their diagnostics, on their care plan, on specifically, you know, perhaps even some of the critical context that we're using to make decisions about their care is transparently shared with the patient. And so whereas in the past, there's oftentimes maybe a reluctance to share that density and that amount of information with the patient, I think that, you know, in some models today, we're seeing that transparency is a real bridge to bringing the actual patient into the care team and making them just as invested, if not more invested, in seeing the success of that program. So I personally am a big believer in having that patient-centered approach, making sure that they are engaged, driving that transparency of information, of clinical context with that patient. I think we've all had the experience of feeling like, I wish I could get that particular, you know, result from my doctor, or even maybe following up and seeing if we can get that. It's difficult today. And so I think starting to really drive that information symmetry will be critical and important. And frankly, what we're seeing there is when the patient is involved and they're actually adherent to their care plan, they're working with the providers to actually communicate how they're feeling, perhaps differences in what their expectations are, maybe what the provider's expectations are against what they're actually seeing or experiencing, that we can be much better at providing care to those patients. And we see that not only in our own practice at Heartbeat, but we see that, you know, in the literature as well. So it's going to be critical and fundamental for us to find ways to get patients more involved over time.
Yeah, that's a great vision. And it's so encouraging to hear that there's already tried and true methods for encouraging patient engagement. Of course, it's always something that can, you know, from the very beginning, good nutrition, watching for your own signs and going to the doctor, very important. I want to turn back to your entrepreneurial role. You are on the Entrepreneurship Advisory Board at the University of Virginia School of Engineering specifically, and you have been for 7-8 years or so. I'm wondering what your goals are to achieve through your involvement with the entrepreneurial community in the engineering school.
So I think, you know, we've had a few fits and starts of, you know, kind of entrepreneurial initiatives at the engineering school. And part of that is it's oftentimes hard to pinpoint what's the right way to think about entrepreneurship within the context of the larger you know, engineering purpose and you know, goal, which is to educate kind of not only future engineers and future leaders for engineering at, you know, in the organization, but also to do fundamental research as well in the engineering community. So, you know, that there's no right answers to any of this, and I think what's important is that we bring university affiliated entrepreneurs to the table, that we bring researchers from the university, administrators from the university, all to the same table to talk about this issue. There's a lot of benefits to working together. I think one of the things that we do at Heartbeat is we do a lot of research to try to understand specifically what are we seeing from an outcome perspective, what are we seeing from a cost perspective with different models of care. We can scale some of that, you know, that type of work when we work with universities, and oftentimes we do work with the universities to do that type of work. And so universities play a really, really important and critical role in helping even industry drive an understanding rigorously of the benefits of what they're doing or the safety impacts of what they're doing. And so I like to feel like, you know, if we can find ways to create a little bit more cross-pollination between universities and startups specifically, and even some of the outcomes-led initiatives that we're doing, we would benefit greatly. But there are a lot of other areas too where I think, you know, there can be benefits. One of the first is that universities tend to be better structured to do deep tech. So really do fundamental first principles research that in an industry setting would be considered maybe too high risk or wouldn't have the return profile that would be required to put an investment into. And so, you know, universities can do that type of work and identify the avenues or the approaches that are fruitful and that ultimately are going to be the places where industry should place some focus and accelerate, you know, kind of adoption of some of these innovations. And so I do think there is kind of this identifying which swim lanes, you know, each kind of domain should sort of be in, and then, you know, kind of expressing the strengths of those domains. You know, in particular at UVA, I think I benefited. I'm kind of an interesting case study that I was a graduate student at UVA, and I got the entrepreneurial bug, and I decided to pursue that early, even while I was at UVA, and I was afforded that opportunity. And so, you know, finding ways to let some of the students that want to explore that as an avenue, do that, I think is really important. Giving them the types of mentors that are necessary to ultimately help them in their development, without necessarily sort of sacrificing some of the research aims. You know, I think I was able to effectively balance, the need to do fundamental research and to educate myself, but also to learn more about entrepreneurship. And I think there is a balance that can be struck there. So certainly universities play a huge role in that. I'm really encouraged by some of the recent activity at the university, especially around entrepreneurship. I think we've seen kind of, a back and forth in terms of how much do we invest in, kind of some of the entrepreneurial led initiatives or not. And I think we're kind of in this, resurgence of interest in the area. And I think that's ultimately healthy. And I actually think that the types of people, whether at the you see at the graduate school level that are doing research or even undergrads that are interested in entrepreneurship, they make for great entrepreneurs. I believe that we can not only educate great engineers and great engineering leaders, but we can educate great entrepreneurs in the future as well.
Well, that's really great to hear, the resurgence. Certainly on engineering, STEM entrepreneurship has a very special place in my heart. And the Culture Translational Research Center, which this podcast is produced by, specifically focuses on that for the biomedical engineering area. Could you mention if there's any particular initiatives or activities that you've seen particularly benefit student entrepreneurs, undergraduate or graduate, that you would advocate for or would want to make them aware of?
I think early on, in the Entrepreneurship Advisory Board, I think hasn't been as active, I think over the past number of years, but I think earlier on, we had individuals that were specifically focused on identifying student-led teams that were interested in attacking critical problems and helping them, whether it's like for the ACC and Venture competition or whatnot, helping them coalesce, produce like sort of really compelling arguments for those particular competitions and ultimately show well in those competitions. I think we won probably the majority of those that I was that I saw at least. And so I think that was really helpful. And what we saw just with that groundswell of activity were a number of startups actually come out of the engineering school in the biomedical domain even. That are still active and doing really well. And so I tend to find that when you create the environment that ultimately drives interest in entrepreneurship, there's a whole lot of intangible side effects that yields, including getting other folks that perhaps are on the sideline and maybe lightly interested to get off the sideline and ultimately jump in. And so I'm a big believer in creating the environment first. That really pushes forward this notion that you can be a researcher or you can be a student, but you can also be an entrepreneur. And I think that and is critical. Like, you don't have to pick one side or the other. And I think you can do both really well, especially at the university. And at which point you decide to leave the university, you can continue on whatever path makes you happy, but ultimately you'll be set up to do either. So the environment's critical. Having that top-down support from the dean's office, which I know is there now, I think is really important. And then having the types of entrepreneurs, kind of in orbit that can help assist with student-led initiatives or faculty-led initiatives, that can lend a helping hand, that can be just kind of a kind ear to listen to the challenges of local entrepreneurs. Is really helpful as well. So we really have to kind of think about this as an ecosystem and to foster kind of an environment in which these entrepreneurs or, potential entrepreneurs will be successful.
Well, excellent. Mark, you have been just a wealth of knowledge on where the healthcare system is heading, how we can better manage people's cardiac health, both by preventing and also assisting with the care once it's in progress, and of course on what student and faculty can be looking forward to in an emerging entrepreneurship with research. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And we will be announcing season 2 very soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Dasha. Had a lot of fun here.
Thank you for listening to Biomedical Frontiers, stories with innovators in healthcare. My name is David Chen, and I am the Managing Director of the Wallace H. Coulter Center for Translational Research at the University of Virginia. Our mission is to help bring promising new biomedical research and technology into the hands of the provider and the patient. If you found this episode valuable, please let us know by subscribing, following, or sharing. You can learn more about our promising translational research projects on our website. See links in the show notes.